ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon. Welcome to The Country Hour. I'm Cassie Huff. Soon you're going to hear the National Farmers Federation's response to the development of a new national food security strategy.
If we don't start addressing these key issues now, that will have an impact on our ability not only to grow food, but also grow it at an affordable price.
And that then flows on to the consumer. So listening to what they make of the government's latest plan, it's called Feeding Australia, and I'll have some more details soon. It's also been a year since the Victorian government reinstated dingo protections in the northwest of Victoria, and I'll have more on what effect that's starting to have on this side of the border as well. But in the last 7 days, it's pretty much embodied the phrase, there are decades when nothing happens and weeks when decades happen, because as you've heard in the news in the last 24 hours, the United States increased tariffs on China by an extra 10%, and China has retaliated with their own tariffs. US President Donald Trump has also confirmed his administration's going to enforce 25% tariff on goods from Mexico and Canada, stoking concerns of a North American trade war and sending Australian shares down sharply as well. So there's a lot happening. Agriculture and sustainability economist at the Commonwealth Bank, Dennis Voznesensky, has been following the news.
You are absolutely right. There is so much that's happening. First of all, the US wanted to put an extra 10% tariff on all Chinese goods, which they did. China responded on the same day saying they're going to put 15% tariffs on U.S. wheat, corn, cotton, and chicken, and then 10% tariffs on soybean, sorghum, pork, and beef. In the same 24-hour period, the U.S. Trump administration put in tariffs on Mexico and Canada. Canada started retaliating. Mexico said they're going to wait a couple of days, I believe until the 9th of March. And that's kind of masked another big thing that's been happening in global, is something that's been happening in global grain markets, and that's the fact that the new U.S. administration has also paused military funding for Ukraine, following quite a vocal fallout in relations between President Zelensky and President Trump at a meeting at the White House last week. So it is an absolute torrent of news lately.
So looking at that, what is appearing to be at least an escalation of trade tariffs between China and the US, what implications does that have for Australian agricultural exports?
So if we take it at face value, China putting tariffs on US wheat, corn, and beef would be beneficial for us. So, for example, if China needs to import wheat or other feed grains, for example, they could come to us and they'll be supportive of us. The one thing to consider, though, is last year there were until probably quarter three, there were very strong imports from China, and that was despite them actually having quite poor economic activity and domestic demand. So it feels like they stocked up and they were prepared for this latest round of trade wars. Now, in terms of what the impact is for Australia, will we benefit straight away? Well, most likely they're going to have this kind of stocks runway where they have enough for several months to negotiate, and that will allow them to negotiate with America. If it comes to the end of that period, and they start running lower on, say, stocks of feed grains or other commodities, then they'll come to us, and that's when we'll benefit. With beef, because you can't store it for as long as you can, for example, wheat and corn, that I think is going to be one of the areas that does benefit, because China has put those tariffs on US beef, so we could be a beneficiary there.
These are the tariffs that have actually been implemented, but President Trump also discussed the possibility of putting across-the-board tariffs on all agricultural imports into the US. And given they are now Australia's largest beef export destination, what effect do you see that happening?
Well, the first question is, do we expect it to happen? I think due to the situation we are with the trade, in terms of trade surplus versus deficit with America, we're actually in a pretty favorable position. So we buy more than we export to the U.S. overall of goods. So we're in a pretty favorable position not to have those tariffs put on us. If they do get put onto everything, onto every country, including Australia, whether we're at a benefit or not is determined by comparatively, are we still better off? So, for example, the US has put 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico. They supplied last year around 37% of the beef that went into the US. So the amount of beef that the US imports, 37%. Now, if the US only puts 10% tariffs on us and 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico, comparatively, we're still better off. So we should still be at a benefit. That's specifically what I'm watching. How do we compare to the tariffs being placed on other countries?
You mentioned Ukraine, as you mentioned,
yes.
The President Trump has said he's pausing military funding for Ukraine. How could this affect the price of grain in particular, given that the Black Sea region is a particularly strong grain area?
Yes, so this news came out early yesterday morning, Australia time, and then it was sort of masked by everything else that happened between then and the end of the day. President Donald Trump has said that they'll be pausing military funding for Ukraine. And when journalists followed up with U.S. government officials, they said that military equipment not currently in Ukraine, but that is in transit, so on the way, that will be paused. The important thing to watch is if that means Ukraine's deep sea ocean ports will be more susceptible to Russian missile attacks. So Ukraine, out of all the avenues that it exports through, 80% goes through those Odessa deep sea ocean ports, 80%, so four-fifths. And if Ukraine can't export through that area because they can't defend it due to a reduction in U.S. military funding, it likely means that they're going to reduce how much they export. And last year, they were just under 10% of global wheat exports. So it's still substantial despite the war ongoing, and that's where the impact would be. If they can't export through those deep sea ocean ports or their ability is reduced, that will reduce how much grain comes out of Ukraine, and that will support global prices and the prices here in Australia too.
It is said, though, that when trade wars happen, everyone loses. So overall, what effect do you see these shifting tides in terms of tariffs and what's happening on the world stage having on Australia's agricultural exports?
Well, we have to look shorter term and longer term. So shorter term, there are winners and losers. So far, the winners, from an Australian perspective, appear to be beef and grains, while the loser at this point looks to be canola. Now, it is important to note that there are officials even inside the president's administration that are now saying some of those tariffs may be rolled back in the coming days, and that's something that they're discussing. But at the moment, there are winners and losers in the short term. In the longer term, well, for Australia, an environment where there's more trade wars is problematic because we've thrived and grown in an environment where there's been free trade globally. And if you look at our agricultural production over the last however long you want to look at it, 30 years, 60 years, the part that has grown is the export part. Say we produce 30% more, compared to, say, 10 years back, the vast majority of all that new production is going overseas. So the less stable overseas markets are and the less predictable, the more stunted the growth moving forward of our industry is likely to be. So longer term, it's not beneficial. In the short term, there are some winners there.
Commonwealth Bank economist Denis Voznesensky speaking there, and it'll take some time to see what effect these tariffs will have, but hopefully it doesn't have too much effect on Australia. But as was mentioned there will be winners and losers. Looking more domestically now, this week the federal government announced the development of a new national food security strategy dubbed Feeding Australia. The plan is a $3.5 million commitment to secure the country's food system, which faces growing pressures given the uncertain trade, soaring production prices and a changing climate. David Jahinki, the president of the National Farmers Federation, says that by addressing these hurdles, the plan will benefit both industry and consumers as the price of fresh food should stabilise and potentially decrease.
The NFF is excited that the government has taken up the opportunity to develop a food strategy / plan for Australian agriculture. We understand that agriculture is exposed to a lot of variabilities, but on top of those climatic and systems that we currently used, we're seeing the potential for disruption to occur not only on our input side, our opportunity to either have access to diesel or fertilizer or chemistry, but then also through the supply chain. And if we can address some of those core vulnerabilities within our system, we'll have not only a more robust food production methodologies, but also stop any increase in food costs purely because we are addressing some of those key risks that are inherent within our system.
So you are confident that the price of fresh Australian food will decrease under this plan?
Well, we're not really sure how much impact we can have immediately on the cost of living crisis. But what we do know is if we don't start addressing and having these conversations now, the future of food production, the future of the cost and variable production systems that can be exposed by either international trade or opportunity to get access to our key inputs, even looking at our policy settings, if we don't start addressing these key issues now, that will have an impact on our ability not only to grow food, but also grow it at an affordable price. So it's not going to be something that instantly changes the situation we find ourselves in, but if we're not addressing these key critical issues as a whole of government strategy, that's the future for us is uncertain, and we want to try to get either rigour and or processes in place that address, once again, these key critical issues, these big issues around inputs, bureaucracy or even legislation, and even then markets. We're not addressing these issues now. We're concerned that they're going to have a huge impact on us in the future.
Obviously, you're happy with this announcement, but do you think that $3.5 million is enough?
We're definitely going to work with government as an industry to see what areas need to be addressed. But this is more of a planning process than an actual doing process. And we hope that that is enough funding to get us to understanding these key macro vulnerabilities or issues or risks that need to be managed. But as a whole, this announcement, this plan in itself doesn't actually get the action on the ground in the long run. It's about making sure that we're making the right strategic moves, understanding the key risks, and then the consequences for not addressing those risks as an industry, as a food production industry and supply chain. And then from there, we want to make sure that we're producing both good policy and investing in good projects to address the issues.
Will the National Farmers Federation be on the National Food Council that's going to inform this strategy?
We definitely want the industry to be involved, and if we can participate in that conversation, we would take up that opportunity.
You mentioned regulatory hurdles being a pain for farmers and being part of the food security problem. What sort of hurdles are we talking about there? And realistically, do you think the government would wind that back?
So, for example, we've got currently three levels of oversight into our native vegetation rules. And as a farmer myself, I understand that to have both compliance and even navigating those three levels of oversight is both what I would consider a burdensome act, but then also extremely hard to navigate, making it nigh impossible. And if we were serious about having a single touch of either legislation, it should be governed by only one jurisdiction, not all three. And that's just one example. Another one is industrial relations. The fact that a small to medium business has a huge compliance component that actually doesn't assist the employee or employer, when that should be done either by an ombudsman or potentially inspections by the relevant authorities, is a far better outcome instead of just creating more burden on the individual farm, the individual business itself.
These recommendations come off the Agriculture Standing Committee's Feeding the Nation and Beyond report, which was released in November 2023. Why do you think it's taken the government so long to actually implement this?
I'm not really sure about the vagaries of how and why this hasn't been supported in the past. What I do know is that both sides of politics has got behind this initiative. They both believe that this is a good pathway forward. And once again, it's great that we're going to be establishing a plan and looking at these key issues. What we are going to be making sure is that on the back end of this, whatever recommendations come out of it, that becomes core policy for both sides of government as well.
With a third of vegetable growers wanting to leave the industry in the next 12 or so months, do you think a plan like this coming from the federal government actually does bolster some confidence in the industry and the future of it?
With the amount of pressure that's on numerous parts of our industry, and that's once again highlighted in the fact that there is a lot of pain in the horticultural sector, demonstrates that something has to be done, and something has to be done of significance to make sure that the affordability of our food is maintained, but also the profitability of our farms is also enhanced so that they have got a future. And this plan hopefully covers both of those key elements of ensuring we're productive but also efficient in how we run the whole supply chain as well as the food production systems.
President of the National Farmers Federation, David Jahinke, speaking with Jane McNaughton. It's 19 minutes past 12.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Weather's up next. It's always the known variable in a lot of these plans. But before we get there, the latest outlook from ABARES for Australian agriculture has livestock leading the way with a predicted record value of $40 billion for the 2025-26 financial year. The ABARES conference began in Canberra this morning with the outlook for all of forestry and fisheries coming in at just under $100 billion with a predicted figure of $98 billion, which is a goal that NFF in particular has had to crack that $1 billion mark. Executive Director of ABARES, Dr. Jared Greenville, has spoken to Larissa Smith about the livestock sector, saying that it's looking very healthy for the period with continuing good prices expected.
Overall, we saw the sector reach its second highest value on record, up to $92 billion. And that was through some improvements in our cropping outcomes in Western Australia, some well-timed rain. We did see dry conditions through South Australia and parts of Western Victoria, which did limit their output, but it was better than I think expected. But some stellar conditions in New South Wales and parts of Queensland, which really lifted overall production.
Grain production values, though, have fallen.
Yeah, we've seen some softening of international prices. So, I mean, we'll go into a period of considerable uncertainty again, but some of the uncertainty that was initially created last year through the invasion of Ukraine did lead to higher grain prices and also some lower production across a number of our Northern Hemisphere competitors. That's come off a bit, and then we've seen some lower grain prices, but kind of backed in with some higher production though.
Can you break that down into winter versus summer?
Yep. So in terms of the overall production, so we saw winter crop production reach close to 60 million tonnes, so 59.8 million tonnes, which is about 27% above the 10-year average. And we also were expecting that when the summer crop kind of wraps up, that will be above the 10-year average, about 28%, and about 4.7 million tonnes. So that summer crop's really been driven by those good conditions in New South Wales and Queensland, and we've seen higher production out of those regions.
So what's your forecasting model looking like for prices when it comes to those crops in the coming season?
Yeah, we're expecting the prices to improve slightly for most of our grains, so for wheat and for canola and for barley. That's off the back of effectively some growing international demand, but also some less exportable surpluses in a number of markets. And so grain prices had softened this year, but we're expecting them to start to improve as we go into next year, 25-26.
What about red meat? That's perhaps got more of a shining light.
Yeah, red meat has been quite successful in terms of our export performance. We've seen beef and veal exports up 20% over this year. And when we look into next year, we're expecting the improvement that we saw in livestock prices this year coming back from some really low prices last year where we were well below long-term averages to really come back to the long-term average for beef, around 2% above. For sheep, it's a bit of a mixed story. So lamb's kind of coming back to the long-term average, but mutton prices will remain, you know, close to 40% below the long-term average. And also for sheep specialists in particular, wool's the other element of that. And we're seeing wool prices really since COVID stay low, and we're expecting them to remain low.
Well, we're forecasting the lowest wool production in Australia on record.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's really coming on the back of those consistent low prices. And we're seeing producers changing behaviour. We're seeing a shift in the flock towards more meat varieties. And we're also just seeing, I guess, farmers holding less sheep because of the returns have been quite low. And I think the global uncertainty is not going to help. We've got a fairly low exchange rate between China and the US, fairly depressed economic conditions for consumers in China at the moment, lowering demand and being, I guess, very sensitive to macroeconomic conditions, wool prices. Expect that it's likely to continue.
Well, you probably can't really pick a time where there's been more geopolitical turmoil that you're in. How do you think that's going to influence agricultural production and also exports in the coming year?
It is certainly a very kind of uncertain time in markets for both the way that the international trading rules are playing out and the enforcement of those rules, but also, as you say, the shifting geopolitical dynamics and conflicts and how they will resolve. One of the things, though, at the moment, given our exchange rate and also our our seasonal conditions, we're at quite a competitive, you know, supply point, and our exports have been, you know, supported by strong demand. Those low oil prices across our red meat have increased demand as we've been able to service a number of markets. So we think when we turn to next year, despite all this uncertainty, that the fundamentals for the sector remain strong. And so there's good demand in a number of markets that we should be able to access given our options. And so that should hopefully help buffer some of these waves that we'll see. But it is uncertain.
Because you look at a country like America, it's our largest buyer of beef and lamb as well. And so you just, with that volatility, you just don't know what switch will be flicked to turn those tables.
That's right. And one of the things with the US market, at least, is that currently their beef herd is, you know, low after fairly, I guess, consistent destocking given their seasonal conditions. And it's around the lows around the 1950s. So as it looks to rebuild, there will be strong demand for beef. And one of the things that, you know, Australian exports of beef into the US are helping support is, you know, red meat in the mouths of consumers in the US. And so in some senses, it's a tide that, you know, lifts all boats, that it provides the breathing space for the domestic industry to rebuild and keeps consumer demand strong. And so hopefully those kind of fundamentals get seen through.
President Trump does like his hamburgers.
That's right.
But whether or not he knows half of them come from Australia is another thing. National broadacre farm cash income. That's an interesting story.
That is an interesting story. So we saw last year broadacre farm cash income really fall back. So we had a couple of things going on, both those livestock prices and wool prices being low, but also a bit of a reversal in the overall package of kind of farm costs to farm incomes, this terms of trade we talk about. And that really closed. So we had farm costs going up, farm prices overall revenues going down, and farm cash incomes really, really fell. This year we're seeing a big turnaround on that. Part of that's from the production story, but a large part of that's those prices that we're seeing. And we're seeing, expecting that farm cash incomes will increase by around 72% this year, up to around $213,000 per farm. And with next year, with the expectations that we have around conditions, but also some of those movements in prices, a further 20%. So farm cash incomes on average to go up to around $260,000.
And is that dependent on those prices? Because I would have to argue that in the last year, farmers that had lower crop yields, say in Victoria and South Australia, would have really felt it.
Yeah, that's right. So that picture of average broadacre farm cash income is not uniform across the landscape. And we do see, you know, those areas which haven't been able to produce, like getting good prices, doesn't really help if you've got nothing to sell. And so that will impact differently across. And the further improvements that we would likely to see into next year will again kind of be dependent on if we can realise some of those production outcomes. And of course, there's a number of factors that we, you know, are still yet to play out. And we haven't planted a winter crop yet. So there's a lot of time to play.
There is, and we are still looking for that rain. Executive Director of ABARES, Dr. Jared Greenville, with the latest outlook for Australian agriculture, speaking there with Larissa Smith. And the 2025-26 period has agriculture, along with forestry and fisheries, predicted to hit that $98 billion, with the livestock sector contributing $40 billion of that figure. And this ABARES conference is going to continue in Canberra for the next couple of days, and Larissa Smith will chair several sessions at the conference, so we might have some more information coming out of that. But we'll find out the latest in the weather situation, where I am joined by senior forecaster Simon Timke. Good afternoon.
Hi there, Cassie.
Well, we might be hearing a lot about what's happening in southern Queensland. It's pretty much an opposite situation here in South Australia. What are you seeing?
It sure is. We wouldn't mind seeing a little bit of the rainfall from up there, but unfortunately there's not really much to speak of for SA. Looking at the satellite picture at the moment, mostly clear skies right across the state. The exceptions over sort of Nullarbor Plain and near the far west coast there, and also about southern coast, where we're seeing a little bit of cloud start to push up in the onshore flow around the next high pressure system that's slowly becoming established over waters south of the Bight. As that high does sort of strengthen over that position, we'll see the south to southwesterly winds become pretty fresh and gusty, so a little bit windy today and continuing into tomorrow. particularly about the south, but even in the north, I think we'll see some pretty fresh winds and some pretty strong and gusty gully winds expected about the western slopes of the Mount Lofty Ranges overnight and into tomorrow morning as well. So a bit breezy at times, but generally dry. There could be the odd isolated light shower near southern and western coasts out of some of that cloud, but generally any totals out of that would be pretty insignificant, I think. That south to southeasterly airstream is keeping temperatures a little bit below average about the coastal fringe, but further inland temperatures above average and pretty hot right up in the far northeast of the state. Tomorrow, a very similar sort of day. As I mentioned, some strong and gusty gully winds about the Mount Lofty Ranges to start off with. And with the trees being a little bit stressed, I guess, with the such dry conditions we've had, I guess it does give them, I suppose, a higher risk of them getting some sort of damage or blown down with those gully winds. So probably a slightly elevated risk of trees down with the level of stress that they're experiencing at the moment due to the drier conditions. Looking a little bit further ahead into the Friday and weekend period, we see an upper trough move across from the west, which does cause conditions to destabilise a little bit across the west and the north of the state in particular. So we could see a little bit of isolated shower and possible thunderstorm activity about parts of the west and north on Friday and Saturday, most likely each afternoon and evening. But it's very broad, so I wouldn't expect anything terribly organised, so it will be fairly isolated. That weather will contract a little bit eastwards on Sunday, be confined to areas about eastern districts and areas about and east of the Flinders and Mount Lofty Ranges. And right through that period, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, maximum temperatures continuing to be above average. So warm to hot conditions right across the state. Early next week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, mostly dry, just the chance of an isolated shower or thunderstorm in the far west, but the remaining parts of the state should remain dry. Rainfall totals for that four-day period out to the end of Sunday, not much to speak of, less than 1 to 2 millimetres near southern and far western coasts with that light shower activity. There is the chance that somewhere across the north and west might pick up a little bit more with a thunderstorm, possibly 2 to 10, but it won't be widespread, fairly isolated falls of those sort of order of magnitude. So generally speaking, unfortunately, not much rain to speak of, Cassie.
It does continue, and the outlook isn't looking terribly indicative one way or the other as to what the rest of autumn is going to hold. So we'll keep following up with you. Thanks for that, Simon Himke.
Thanks, Cassie.
And to the far west of New South Wales now, and the upper western will be mostly sunny. There's a slight chance of a shower in the northeast. There is also the possibility of a thunderstorm in the northeast as well in the afternoon and evening. Winds are actually getting up to 25 to 35 kilometres an hour as well. Overnight temperatures will fall to the low to mid 20s. Daytime temperatures reaching the mid to high 30s though. The lower western will be sunny. Overnight they're dropping to 18 to 22 degrees, and the daytime temperatures reaching the mid to high 30s. It's 27 minutes to one.
You and I are going to share a little secret.
Find unmissable entertainment like The Newsreader, Mystery Road Origin, Mayfair Witches, and so much more.
It's ambitious.
Where it's always free, always unmissable. ABC iView.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, it's great to have your company today. I am Cassie Huff for the Country Hour, and the surface water situation in South Australia continues to intensify. The drought continues. There's been a focus on the domestic water situation in the Hills and Fluorio in the last week or so, but livestock producers are getting pretty concerned about their access to water as well.
Like, I don't have a lawn at the moment. I don't have any green. My trees are dying. Wildlife are probably suffering as well because they don't have the water sources either. So it's quite devastating not only to people but also the natural resources around as well.
Yeah, the ground is bone dry, and those boars are getting quite the hammering. So we'll have a little look at some water shortages in the Adelaide Hills when it comes to livestock, but we'll continue this discussion tomorrow as well. Also, Australia's largest sheep station, Rulina, has been sold to Consolidated Pastoral Company. It's a 1 million hectare property on the Nullarbor in the West Australian, South Australian border region. So we'll take a look at what that sale means. But first, we have to find out what's making news. And Matt Coleman has the latest. Good afternoon.
Hello, Cassie. In the news this afternoon, a former Adelaide lawyer who drank more than a litre of wine before fatally crashing into a pedestrian has been jailed for 8 years. 33-year-old Lauren Jean Wilgoose was sentenced in the district court this morning. She was earlier found guilty of causing the death of neuropsychologist Anthony Walsh and leaving the scene of the Goodwood Road crash in June 2021. Australia's gross domestic product rose 0.6% in the December quarter, taking the annual growth rate to 1.3%. GDP per person rose 0.1% in the quarter after seven consecutive declines and pulling Australia out of a long-running per capita recession. And water supplies will be provided by the state government at three locations near Adelaide tomorrow to ease demand on water carting businesses. They're in high demand, with hundreds of properties not connected to mains water starting to run dry due to low rainfall in the Adelaide Hills. Water supplies will be provided from 7 a.m. at Brookunga, Woodside and at Sandergrove near Strathalbyn. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Matt. Now, continuing on from that water discussion, if you're getting or if you're needing to get water delivered at the moment, how long are you actually waiting for deliveries? I'd be interested to know. You can text 0467 922 783 or call 1300 160 222. A lot of the focus has been on the Adelaide Hills, where there's a large population and not a lot of surface water there. But there's also water carting happening right around the state and into the Kangaroo Island area as well, and these dry conditions are continuing. Many properties are just not on mains water and are facing shortages, and water carters are struggling to keep up. We've been following this for a little while now. As was mentioned there, from tomorrow, three temporary emergency bulk water collection points will be established in the Adelaide Hills in response to what's been called unprecedented dry conditions and unmet water carting demands. And Callington alpaca farmer Jody Burr says accessing water has been a major challenge.
I usually have been buying in maybe one truckload a year since the drought in 2019, but this year, in the last 3 months, I've had 10 truckloads.
You got one last Friday, is that right? Or just in the last week?
Saturday.
Yeah. And so when did they say they can come back?
In 6 weeks. So my next booking is on the 28th of April. So that's about 6 weeks. And that was the earliest. And she knows that I've got alpacas and I've been like a regular customer of hers. So she always tries to fit me in. But yeah, this year it's just gone ridiculous. And it's even worse than the drought in 2019. And at least the drought in 2019 used to be able to ring up and get the water if need be, but this time, it's a 6 week wait and people are just running out all over the place. So it's amazing how many people don't live where there is mains water. People in the city just don't understand that if we run out of water, we can't brush our teeth, we can't flush the toilets, we can't have a shower, we can't give the water to the animals. So there's a whole health risk as well to everybody that can't get the water in. And not only the health risk, but also the mental health as well. So it's quite stressful knowing that your animals are going to run out of water, because at least I guess I can go down and get a drink from down the shop, but I can't send 100 alpacas down the shop to get a drink. So quite concerning. And I don't want to sell the alpacas at the moment because people are in a drought. So at least here I know that they're getting water, I know that they're getting food. So that's why I haven't been looking to rehome them, because I just don't want them to suffer. You can see, like, I don't have a lawn at the moment, I don't have any green, my trees are dying. Wildlife are probably suffering as well, because they don't have the water sources either. So it's quite devastating, not only to people but also the natural resources around as well. And people are using a lot more bore water, which means the aquifers are being drained, which means there'll be a lot saltier in the future as well. So quite devastating, really, people that live in the suburban areas, because they just don't realise people live on rainwater. And one of the comments I got on Facebook when I posted warning people that they needed to pre-book their water delivery because it's going to be dry autumn as well. One of the comments I got was that you live in the country, you know that you don't have mains water, so you deal with it basically. So, but they just don't understand that this is where their food comes from. So a lot of wheat's been grown around here, canola's grown, so that it's a big cereal country around here. Plus sheep as well. People have been selling sheep, so that means their meat prices are going to go up when there's no sheep left because they've all been slaughtered and nobody's breeding them anymore because of the drought. So it has an impact on the suburbs as well. But people just don't realise that. They go into Coles, they buy their lamb or their steak for dinner, but they don't realise that those sheep and those cows have to have water.
Yeah, there's certainly flow-on effects everywhere. That was alpaca farmer Jodie Burr in the Adelaide Hills speaking to Caroline Horn. And you can read more about this and the emergency measures being taken to supply water to people in the hills in Fleurieu at abc.net.au. And we will continue looking at some issues further afield, Kangaroo Island in particular, and elsewhere in South Australia when it comes to water carting. And I'm interested to know how long you're waiting for deliveries or perhaps what else the state could be doing to ensure water is available. You can text 0467922783 or call 1300 160 222. Now, this next issue is not a direct issue related to drought in particular, but it is exacerbating it, and that is the fact that it's been a year since the Victorian government's decision to reinstate dingo protections in the northwest of Victoria took place. It's again prompted South Australian producers to raise serious concerns about the impact on this side of the border. Livestock SA says the decision has led to a surge in wild dog activity in South Australia. CEO Travis Tobin told me there's been 26 separate reports of wild dog sightings and attacks in the Narkat Conservation Park and properties nearby in that time.
As you and your listeners would probably remember, we were quite concerned about this decision in March last year when it was made, largely because it was really made in a jurisdictional silo, so even though it impacted other states, it lacked any consultation with the South Australian government, with industry bodies, or with the impacted producers and communities. So it challenged some of the thinking as well around what taxonomy was for dingoes and those sorts of things. It lacked a peer review of the underpinning report. So at the time, we just saw it as a very hasty, unconsultative way to make a decision that impacts others. So we've always been a bit concerned about the way it was made, and we were always concerned about the impacts it would have on producers in our state in that northwest Victoria border region. So, they have had problems in that area before. So, particularly during the 80s and 90s, there were lots of producers who were losing, in that part, who were losing several hundred sheep a year being attacked. It has impacts on conception rates, it has impacts on marking percentages, and it obviously impacts stress levels, therefore wool quality's down and prices are lower. So, that's the economic impacts, but then there's also the emotional impacts on producers. And when they're in really difficult times like now, experiencing drought and things are tough, the last thing you need is something like that to start to play on your mind and be something you have to face every day as well. So what are we seeing? We've seen, the reports in Victoria about increased wild dog attacks and those sorts of things are happening. In South Australia, we've seen 26 separate reports of wild dog sightings in the Narkat Conservation Park and the nearby properties, and we've also seen 3 livestock attacks, and we weren't seeing that before.
And what effect is the drought having on this as well?
Yeah, so the hot, dry conditions basically exacerbate the issue because the dogs come to water, etc. The animals are around water, so that the two don't really mix very well when they're looking for a drink. So, and as I said before, the real impacts on a producer are tough. We're seeing some of the driest conditions ever experienced for some producers, but for others, it's they're in their second year of drought, and for livestock producers, they're essentially in their third year of tough times because we had a livestock pricing collapse through 2023. So, they're in a position where they're already doing it difficult. Yes, they're very resilient people, but we all have resilience limits, and we don't need to add wild dog attacks on top of that.
So given this was an interstate decision, what are you wanting to see done in South Australia to deal with this?
Yeah, so we've been talking to state government ever since the decision was made last March and looking, obviously looking for jurisdictional collaboration because that's what the issue warrants. We're not seeing that yet. So we are still asking our government to, you know, stand up and, well, we're going to have to do something if we can't get that collaboration between jurisdictions. So, you know, we've asked the government to consider what fencing might be needed, what baiting programs might be needed, what monitoring and trapping might be needed, those sorts of activities. So what's the increase that will be required? Because that control mechanism that was happening across the border isn't now, so therefore it increases the pressure on what's happening on our side of the border through that region.
Because dogs don't really know where the border is. How well is the government taking it, given that essentially the Victorian decision is placing more responsibility on the South Australian government?
Yeah, so our government absolutely understands the issue, and, you know, as we've been really pleased to see, we had a lot of obviously we had a lot of problems with dogs here some years ago. When we look at what was happening prior to the investments that the federal government was also involved with this, but the federal government, state government and the sheep industry made into rebuilding the dog fence in the northern part of the state. So prior to that investment, which was about $29 million to date, you know, we were losing 20,000 sheep a year in South Australia. So the direct financial cost for that at that time was about $4 million or over $4 million per year, and not considering, as I mentioned before, the significant emotional impacts that come with that. And as I said, we've been pleased that our government gets it and they do see that wild dogs need to be managed, and the investments we have seen in the north have been really effective. What we don't want to see is those investments be undermined by things that are now happening in the east of our state, in the border with northwest Victoria, you know, whether it's dogs coming through Big Desert into Narkat, etc., and surrounding properties. That's what we don't want to see, and that's where we're saying if there can't be some jurisdictional collaboration that really does start to address this issue, we'll need our government to act on its own right.
The South Australian government, though, is also developing a new Biodiversity Act to protect and conserve the biodiversity, of which dingoes are a part of that. What concerns do you have that this could impede the ability to get on top of the wild dog problem?
Yeah, so that's obviously just under consultation at the moment, Cassie, but you're right. One of the things that is proposed in that is changing the unprotected species list, so taking dingoes out of that. And again, we don't really fully understand yet how that will work. If we're looking at what Victoria, I'm not saying it's going to be exactly the same because we don't know all the details yet, but what's happened in northwest Victoria is the unprotected order was removed. Obviously, it's a different mechanism, but... And we're sort of seeing the impacts of that, and we definitely don't want to see that here. It really should be a pretty alarming warning for us to say, well, if that's how it plays out when you remove these things, that's not what we want to do.
Livestock SA CEO Travis Tobin. We've got a text in regarding the water situation. Chris has said, I've lived in the Barossa. We have water standpipes at Mount Pleasant, Eden Valley and McCulter, and there's an online log to access water points. You have to pay with PayPal. It costs about $5.20 per kilolitre and everyone has access to it. Why don't other councils implement this sort of system? Thanks so much for your text there, Chris. You can keep the texts coming. The number to text in on is 0467 922 783. It's 12 minutes to 1.
New from ABC Books.
Gang terrorism.
One of Australia's most senior police officers, Nick Caldas, has some stories.
Do good work. Live by your beliefs. Fear no one.
Behind the Badge by Nick Caldas. Book and audiobook available now.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Australia's largest sheep station, Rulina, has been snapped up by a consolidated pastoral company. The 1 million hectare property is on the Nullarbor in the Western Australian, South Australian border region. It's always been owned by the Adelaide-based Jumbuck Pastoral, which has just entered into a sale and purchase agreement with the CPC. CPC is an Australian-managed but UK-owned organisation that's currently mainly running cattle, and CEO Troy Setter says he's pretty happy getting his hands on Rulina because CPC has confidence in the sheep industry.
Yes, CPC formerly were a large owner of sheep in Queensland, but for around the last 20 or so years, we've hardly had any sheep at all. We've only had a small number. So this will be a first sort of big step back into the sheep and wool industry. We do run about 45,000 goats in Queensland, so we are in the small stock industry in a way, I suppose you'd put it.
What appealed to you about Rawlinna and at this time? Because a lot of people are very doom and gloom about the sheep industry here in Western Australia with the impending phase out of the live sheep trade by sea.
Look, Rawlinna is a really good quality station. The Jumbuck have had it since it was pegged by Hugh McLaughlin. It's a really good quality property. It's fair to say in the last few years there's been certainly some challenges in the sheep industry in Australia, but particularly in Western Australia, and the flock has declined a bit, and the market has certainly been tough. We think there's some good opportunities in the Australian sheep industry, and it was a good time to invest.
Do you mind me asking how much you paid for it, or you're going to pay for it?
You can ask, but neither Jumbuck or I are going to tell you.
Fair enough. Did you have much competition though?
Yeah, I believe there was some strong competition. The agents did a good job of keeping us all separated, but from what we could pick up, there was strong competition. It's hard to get a sheep property in Australia of that sort of scale, so it was quite attractive to us and I'm sure to other buyers as well.
If it all does go ahead, what are your plans for it? We just last week did a story about Rawlinna completing their shearing for this year. I think from memory it was around about 26,000 sheep. What are your intentions?
Look, we plan to, one, work with the existing team and staff on the property. We really want to keep them and then, you know, grow the flock. It's been a difficult few years with seasonal conditions and markets, and we think there's a good opportunity to regrow the flock at Rawlinna.
And possibly expand it, because at one stage, it was up around 65,000 sheep, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's been around 65,000 quite a few times. It's rated by the Western Australian government in the mid-80,000 DSE, so we'd like to get it back into the 60s. I think the property could certainly handle it, and it's a pretty exciting opportunity.
Does it make you a bit nervous about the weather, though? Because, I mean, it's 1,000 kilometres east of Perth. It's not too far from the WA-SA border. Last year it had some floods, so it certainly had some lovely rain, and I'm assuming things are looking pretty good now. But it wasn't that long ago it went through a number of years of pretty serious drought.
Yeah, look, it has gone through droughts. It is it is a drier area of Australia, certainly areas that are drier. We've got quite a diverse portfolio across Australia and suffer somewhere in our portfolio every year suffering from some sort of drought. We're absolutely eyes wide open to what we're buying, but we think with the team at Rawlinna and the CPC team that we can manage that.
Any idea at this stage what your intention would be with the sheep when you're selling them? Would they be coming west or east?
Look, I hope that we can have the flexibility to go both ways, to be totally honest. It's been a very tough time for sheep producers in Western Australia, and I really feel for them. I'm hoping that absolutely improves. But the property is in a unique situation to be able to go either east or west. The sheep on Rawlinna are well suited for live export to the Middle East and other markets, and we'll certainly be working with both export and domestic buyers.
Just out of interest, were you also interested in purchasing it when Andrew Forrest was as well? And Fortescue Future Industries sort of had a bit of a lock on it, and they only dipped out last November. They were planning on putting in a green energy hub of some sort, but Twiggy Forrest seems to have gone cold on that idea. But have you been interested in Rawlinna for that long?
We have been interested in it for a while. We weren't involved in the process when Twiggy had it under offer, but we certainly knew about it, and it sparked our interest at that time.
Would you have plans to do anything else on Rawlinna apart from the sheep?
Look, at this stage, we're concentrating on sheep. We see some really good opportunities for sheep.
And just out of interest, how does this purchase fit into CPC's overall plans for your portfolio?
We've been investing in our portfolio and growing and developing our stations. We've bought another two stations in the past 12 months in Queensland, and we'll continue to grow our stations. Probably the biggest investment that we've made, though, in the last 5 years has actually been developing in our existing stations to improve the livestock operations and improve and grow the cropping operations and also natural capital.
So in the future, do you think you're going to be getting more into the sheep on top of Rawlinna?
Look, we'll certainly keep looking at all opportunities, both in cattle, cropping and sheep.
It'll be interesting to see how it goes. Do you expect any hiccups with the Foreign Investment Review Board?
I don't think so. We've had a really good and transparent relationship with the Foreign Investment Review Board for 20 years now. And work closely with them. So we hope not, but we'll always keep a good, transparent relationship with them and never take anything for granted.
Troy Setter, the CEO of Consolidated Pastoral Company, speaking with Richard Hudson about how they've just signed a contract with Jumbuck Pastoral to purchase Rawlinna Station. It's a walk-in, walk-out deal, property, equipment and sheep being transacted, but it is still subject to the Foreign Investment Review Board because CPC is UK-owned. You can read more about this online at abc.net.au/rural. We'll head to the markets now, where Selena Green has this week's Dublin results. Hi, Selena.
Hi, Cassie. Numbers increased this week as agents offered 10,000 lambs and 3,000 sheep. Quality continues to be extremely mixed, with merino lambs again offered in large numbers. One processor buyer was not present and another interstate order did not operate. Specialty butcher competition was again good, along with some good restockers' orders on lighter merino and crossbred lambs. The better lambs suitable to feed on lifted up by $10 a head, as the balance of the lambs saw plainer lots selling firm, as the better end of the lamb sold $10 in advance of the previous sale. Mutton quality was again good, with prices remaining firm on recent improved rates. Extremely light merino lambs sold from $20 to $35, as crossbreds range from $45 to $65 a head. Light merinos sold from $75 to $120, with light trade weights ranging from $120 to $140. Light trade crossbreds sold from $150 to $160. Trade weight merinos sold from $150 to $160, as crossbreds range from $160 to $170. Heavy merino lambs sold from $160 to $200, with heavy crossbreds fetching $170 to $220 a head. Light mutton sold from $30 to $60. Medium weights range from $60 to $80, with heavy weights fetching $80 to $120 a head. Meanwhile, in the cattle market, a much smaller yarding of 164 cattle were on offer, with most being yearling steers and heifers. The cow offering were mostly light and medium weight descriptions. The usual trade and processor buyers were active, along with limited specialty butcher competition and a few restocker orders. Yearling steers sold generally firm from 280 to 340 cents a kilogram. Light and medium weight cows also sold firm, as they made 150 cents to 240 cents per kilogram. This has been Selena Green filling in for John Traeger for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks, Selena. And Peter Kerr has the results from Mount Gambier.
Good afternoon, Cassie. This is the Mount Gambier Cattle Report for the 5th of March. Numbers rose a little as agents gathered 1,110 head of live weight and open auction cattle. These sold a smaller group of trade and processor buyers, with feeders and restocker activities throughout the market. Quality was mixed, with good cattle hard to find in a cheaper sale this week. Feeder steers sold to the trade from 270 to 370 cents, with feeders active at also 270 and restockers to 350. Feeder heifers attracted the trade from 280 to 345 cents, with some feeder interest to also 345 cents a kilogram. Yearling steers sold from 292 to 355 cents to the trade, as similar heifers returned from 256 to 360. Feeders are active here on steers from 280 to 375 cents, on the heifers from 250 to 325 as restockers operated over both sexes from 251 to 349 cents a kilogram. Growing season bullocks sold from 330 to 376 cents to the trade, with feeder support from 348 to 380. Growing heifers returned from 290 to 350 cents to the trade, and to feeders from 285 to 350, as manufacturing steers range from 230 to 280 cents a kilogram. Heavy cows lost up to 35 cents to sell from 260 to 310. Lighter lots from 200 to 260 cents to the trade. And from 258 to 290 cents a kilogram to feeders and restockers. A larger offering of bulls came forward as the heavy lots sold from 250 to 300 cents, with lighter pens making from 200 to 210 cents a kilogram. This has been Peter Kerr for the MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks for that. That's all we have time for in the program. There's more information, though, on abc.net.au/rural. It's coming up to 1 o'clock.
On the siren! You couldn't script it!
The 2025 AFL season is nearly here.
It's a miracle at the Adelaide Oval!
The SA Grandstand team is ready to go. Don't miss the action here on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.